You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 5th of January 2024 on Monocle Radio. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Live from London, this is The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson. A very warm welcome to today's programme. Coming up, Israel strikes Hezbollah targets in Lebanon. We'll explore concerns about a widening conflict in the region. Also ahead, recently freed prisoners chant Ukraine above all, following the largest prisoner swap with Russia since the start of the war. We'll have the latest on the deal. We'll look at how Thailand is raising its game to attract more tourists and...
I'm Monocle's Helsinki correspondent Petri Burtsov, and I'll be talking about the Urban Light Festival, Lux Helsinki.
Plus Louis Vuitton becomes the latest luxury brand to plan to open a hotel. That's all ahead on The Globalist, live from London. First, a quick look at what else is happening in today's news. Israel has outlined plans for the future of Gaza once the war between Israel and Hamas ends. Rescuers say there are still more than 240 people missing following the New Year's Day earthquake in Japan. And the Spice Girls are to become the first all-female group to feature on a British postage stamp. Stay tuned to Monocle Radio throughout the day for more on these stories. But first, the biggest prisoner swap between Ukraine and Russia since the invasion of February 2022 has taken place. The exchange was mediated by the UAE, with more than 200 freed by each side. While Alyona Khlivko is managing director at the Henry Jackson Society, a foreign policy think tank that advocates a robust spreading of liberal democracy, rule of law and the market economy. I'm delighted to say she joins me in the studio. A very warm welcome back to Monocle Radio, Alyona.
Thank you, Emma. Nice to be here.
So good to have you. Now, just explain to us a little bit more about this exchange. Who were these prisoners who were swapped?
It was 230 Ukrainian prisoners of war. They were from the Ukrainian Armed Forces National Border Guard Service, National Guard. So they've been captured in various parts of Ukraine and have been in Russian detainment for quite a long time. Most significantly, Azovstal fighters and our guys from the Snake Island. If you remember the very first instance, one of the first attacks that served a foundation to that famous phrase about Russian warship. Those are the guys that are now back home.
It's astonishing to think that it's actually taken them that long to be part of this exchange. But this was a very, very long process, wasn't it? And as I mentioned a moment ago, the UAE had a role in it. Tell us about that.
Negotiations are generally a very difficult thing. And of course, when it comes to Russia, a rogue terrorist state who doesn't really abide by international norms, it was useful to see that they still went for it just because, of course, to get their own soldiers, number one. And number two, Institute for Study of War made a very interesting observation that that's them trying to basically whitewash themselves, following the claims that they're ready for negotiations late last year, just before they started brutally murdering civilians in Kyiv and across Ukraine over New Year holidays. That's just another smoke and mirrors by Russia. But it's very interesting, as you rightly noticed, that UAE is taking part in that negotiation, and we can see the role of the so-called global south elevated in Ukraine-Russia war, because at first Saudi Arabia is planning to take part in the peace summit that I believe is about to take place in Davos next week. They've been there before. The UAE is now taking part in negotiations about prisoners of war. Qatar has earlier been involved in releasing Ukrainian children. So it's very interesting that those countries are stepping up, seeking their own agency, and it's just another sign of this multilateral world.
And it is a difficult situation to fathom, isn't it, when you realise that the UAE, the prisoner swap has come about by, you know, hard work by the likes of the UAE. The UAE has good relations with Moscow, and that is a crucial element to all this, is that the progress can only be made by using agents who and countries who do actually have a good relationship with Vladimir Putin and with Russia.
I would say it's the good relationship, but it's also leverage. And I feel like the West, unfortunately, even though it's as vague of a term as the global South, we can see that ambiguity that keeps coming from the West. Therefore, it makes space for other agents to arise. Again, going back to the new world order that's being forming in front of us, when we hear those isolationist movements from the United States, for example, that only makes space for other actors to step in and to be the bridge between civilized democratic countries and, again, rogue states like Russia. Of course, negotiation is very important. In today's world, discussions are crucial. But we also have to be very clear about who is gaining more agency and more power on the global stage.
How surprised were you that the UAE was involved in this? I think there was an initial amount of surprise when we saw the scale of the swap. This is the biggest swap, isn't it, since February 2022? But also the fact that the UAE was involved in that. How hopeful are you that more negotiations, similar negotiations, are taking place behind the scenes to release more prisoners and to make more progress?
I think they are, in fact. And even when I was, again, going back to Qatar at the Doha Forum late last year, I spoke to Ukrainian ambassador in Doha, and he said to me that there are many negotiations going on, particularly about Ukrainian children, that no one can talk about because that's a very sensitive issue. But I feel like those multilateral conversations are being held, which is very important. The main thing to look at here is how honest and sincere would Russia be about those? What would they demand in exchange? Besides their own prisoners of war, which concessions they would be counting on?
How many prisoners are we talking about now?
I think currently, according to Ukrainian known numbers, because it's also very difficult to say whether the person's gone missing or is actually in Russian captivity, it's about 4,000 people, only soldiers, fighters, so not even civilians. The civilian numbers are yet to be known.
Tell us a little bit more about the way that the dynamic is working in Ukraine at the moment, that we've seen the return of soldiers, but also we're seeing calls from Volodymyr Zelensky a couple of weeks ago to mobilize those Ukrainian men who are no longer in Ukraine but who are abroad, and they're being told to go back to Ukraine to fight on the front line. What are you hearing about how this is sort of playing out abroad?
That's a very fair sentiment, to be honest, because, as you know, my brother is fighting on the front line and has been since February 2022. So it's almost coming up to 2 years. And I hear those moods. I'm not surprised, therefore, by Zelensky's calls for people to come back to Ukraine, because I hear from my brother and I understand that it reflects the moods of soldiers on the front line, just the level of exhaustion that they're facing, physical as well as moral and mental. They do need to change the scenes, even though they go on rotations, but they're still deployed and training and doing exercises, etc. So we need to reinforce basically our human resources. It's not, the war is not about just military or financial aid. It's also about people abroad. From what I can see, there, of course, have been many refugees across Europe. Here in the UK, it's mostly women and children. But in Europe, when I go visit various countries, I can see that there are many men who even avoided conscription. And it's okay to talk about that. And I think we should be open about that, because not everyone wants to dedicate their life or has the courage to go fight a war. I mean, it's something incomprehensible that completely changes your perspective on life, that you have to go and be able to even murder someone on the front line. That's the level of human tragedy that every single man and a woman who decides to go fight on the front line faces today. So that's not a threat that I think can be taken easily, or just, you know, call them cowards, or just also let them avoid that responsibility, because Ukraine is very accountable in that way. If we keep pleading for humanitarian, financial and military aid from the Western countries and keep saying that you don't need to fight for us, then we need to mobilize our people across Europe.
Tell us a little bit about how the division that might open up there. You place the fact that your brother is currently traveling, going to a deeply dangerous part of the war at the moment. And yet you talk about people who, and the word coward was mentioned. I mean, what do you see will happen in the future when Ukraine does come back together and families are reunited and communities are, do become one again? How do you even begin to reconcile different experiences and different points of view?
I think many humanitarian organizations and just generally realizing that the time after the war for Ukraine will be very difficult. I would say it would be probably as difficult as the time at war, but on a societal level. Social cohesion will certainly be an issue. The country, having come out of most tragic, brutal, atrocious war, will have a lot of mental health issues that will inevitably affect the unity within society. And especially the divisions between those who fought on the front lines, who was mostly on rotation, medics, volunteers, some people who tried to cover up to be volunteers, but actually just tried to avoid the war and responsibility. We are already seeing those divisions in society inevitably, because that's also one of the benefits of democracy. When all of those voices arise, they get represented and heard at the parliamentary level. That's why there are multiple discussions about the mobilization law in the parliament right now, about the duration of people being on the front line, about rotation, about the joint responsibility of society. And that inevitably is a very painful process, but it's a needed one. It needs to happen.
Could you just bring us up to date with a couple of overnight stories that have been breaking to do with the conflict in Ukraine? One of the, there's two things that have happened. Firstly, these missile attacks in Sevastopol. Can you just bring us up to date with what Ukraine's doing?
Ukraine is definitely still trying to target all the ammunition supplies, warehouses, and all the military locations where Russia holds their weapons supplies that they use to attack the south of Ukraine, and that they use to try to hold trade in the Black Sea. Ukraine has been really, really successful at restoring that after Russia pulled out of the grain deal, just to be able to feed the world with Ukrainian grain. We've created that corridor, and now I think over 300 ships have left Ukraine successfully. So that's trying to secure the route for the future harvest, for sure. And of course, trying to protect the south of Ukraine and the civilians, because we saw that Odessa got attacked overnight. Kherson is still getting bombarded every day. That's where it all comes out of.
And finally, one of the stories that's broken overnight is that there's evidence that Russia is using ballistic missiles and launchers in its war on Ukraine, supplied by North Korea. I think the National Security Council spokesman John Kirby says this is a significant and concerning escalation, and that the US is going to raise this at the UN Security Council. How does this change the game if Russia is now using North Korean weapons?
There have been allegations and, in fact, reports by intelligence, both Ukrainian and the U.S. intelligence, about North Korea supplying Russia. It was they were talking about high-tech components, elements to missiles, but now that we definitely know that it's ballistic missiles, and one of them landed in Ukraine over New Year's holidays, so it was possible to identify it and now finally prove it. It's very interesting development, because Ukraine has been facing not just Russia. It has been facing and fighting off the axis of evil with Russia, Iran, because there are some reports that Russia went to Iran to get some missiles there. They are not confirmed yet that they're selling missiles to Russia, but I think that's just a matter of time. And now North Korea. There have been reports that China have been supplying military helicopters to Russia. Ukraine is not just up against one country. It's up against the whole authoritarian regime and the evil axis of this world. The fact that the United States is finally officially talking about it, I think that changes dynamic, because they knew it for some time. Now that they're making it public, I think it signals that they're finally ready to do something about it.
Alena Slivko, thank you as ever for joining me in the studio. You're listening to The Globalist live on Monocle Radio. Just nudging 9:15 a.m. in Beirut, 7:15 a.m. here in London. Now, Israel claims to have targeted and killed several members of Hezbollah in a series of strikes in southern Lebanon. It was one of the deadliest days for the group, which is aligned with Iran and has immediately led to concerns about how the conflict between Israel and Hamas in Gaza may now be spreading. Well, I'm joined now by Monocle's Middle East correspondent, Leila Molana Alan. Good morning, Leila.
Good morning.
So just to outline to us what happened on Wednesday.
So these were strikes that happened in the south of Beirut, in the suburbs of Beirut. And what happened was that there was a meeting that was being held between various factions. It was Hamas, but also a Lebanese militant group in an area that's run by Hezbollah, but it wasn't a Hezbollah meeting. And what happened was that they managed to strike the building and a car outside, killing three members of Hamas and several members of the other militant organisations as well.
Just to explain to us, I mean, how this has left Beirut feeling, because it's the killing of Salah al-Arouri, who's a deputy leader of Hamas, was killed the day before. This suddenly puts the focus very sharply on Beirut.
Well, it does put the focus on Beirut, but the reason they've gone after people in Beirut is that not everybody from Hamas is based in Gaza. And of course, a war has also been ongoing with Hezbollah across the border in the south of Lebanon. So that started, I mean, theoretically, Israel and Lebanon have been at war for years. And of course, there was a huge war in 2006 that killed many people in Lebanon. And since October the 8th, when Hezbollah sent some missiles into Israel across the border as a sort of show of support for the October 7th Hamas attack, there has been ongoing fire back and forth. Now, it's been worse on the Lebanese side in terms of what Israel's been sending in. More than a dozen people have been killed, many of them civilians, and they have taken out Hezbollah militants too. They claim that they've killed more than a dozen of them. Hezbollah says it's a smaller number than that. Israel saying that a few key people were killed yesterday as well. That hasn't been confirmed by Hezbollah yet, but they do usually come out and actually say yes, because they have these large-scale funerals. They also had Salah al-Arouri's funeral and the rest of the Hamas leaders and Islam al-Jamia, the other Lebanese faction leaders that were killed the other day. They had those yesterday in Beirut. Now, people in Beirut are extremely concerned because southern Lebanon has been, a lot of areas of southern Lebanon have evacuated further up into the country because people are so concerned about what's coming across the border. If Israel has taken the step now that they feel comfortable to be targeting people in Beirut with missiles, that's a very different situation. It's not an area entirely run by Hezbollah, although the neighborhood that they carried out the attack in was run by Hezbollah. People are extremely concerned, both in terms of the fact that it shows Israel's very comfortable with potentially inciting a larger conflict, and that it means it could spread into other residential neighborhoods. And Beirut is an incredibly heavily packed city with not great infrastructure, and certainly wouldn't be able to cope with having to send the people who have already evacuated to Beirut, as well as all of Beirut's citizens, somewhere else to take refuge.
Because that's a bigger concern, isn't it? The escalation into a wider conflict.
It is a great concern. It's been a concern since the beginning, since October 7th. Initially, there was a report from Israeli leaders that they had considered in the first few days expanding their operations beyond what they wanted to do in Gaza. They then decided that wasn't a good idea. But as I say, these exchanges of fire have been kind of nudging the needle back and forth. Neither side really wants a war on that frontier. And Hezbollah certainly doesn't want to create a war because they're in a very good position in Lebanon where they run the government, or they have a huge hand in the government, but they really do have the kind of decisive factor at the moment. And they do not want to get caught into a situation where they're blamed by the Lebanese people, many of whom they're already very unpopular with, for starting a war that takes many Lebanese lives. However, if Israel starts the war, that's a very different situation because Hezbollah can then claim that they are defending Lebanon so they would then carry out that war. Now, thus far, the thinking has been that Israel does not want a war on a second front. But what they've done this week has really pushed the needle in terms of how much of a risk they're willing to take. The Israeli Defense Minister, Yoav Gallant, said to a visiting US envoy this week that there was a very narrow window in which they felt that diplomatic proceedings could fix the problems, the tensions with Lebanon at the moment. And of course, Israel says that Lebanon and Hezbollah neighborhoods are harboring these Palestinian militants, as well as Hezbollah, who are declared enemies of Israel, and they're going to do what they need to do to protect themselves. Now, of course, the US and other Western countries are urging restraint. US leaders and French leaders, France is very influential in Lebanon, are trying to get in there and negotiate. They're sending people in to try and make sure this doesn't escalate, but people are extremely concerned. There's a lot of tension on the ground in Lebanon. Of course, most of northern Israel has already been evacuated, and it's just soldiers up there, so they are ready for a war if one does start.
How is this avoided, given the fact that I think as you said, there is a general consensus that a wider conflict is to be avoided, and Iran does not want to get dragged into any kind of conflict via Hezbollah or any other group. But there is a sense, isn't there, that were Israel to up the pressure and to increase the number of strikes, how would Lebanon respond as a nation?
So, sorry for interrupting you. What I was going to say is it's interesting that at the beginning of this sort of post-October 7th period of conflict, everyone thought that Iran was pushing, that Iran, because Iran had funded Hamas, and that they would, this was potentially them pushing a conflict that they want with Israel. It's become very clear that that's not the case. Iran has even stepped forward and sort of said, you know, we were funding Hamas, but we didn't know about this specific attack, and we're certainly not going to step up and conduct an all-out war now. That's not what they're looking for. They've got a lot of their own problems internally to deal with. Now, Lebanon, part of the problem that Lebanon has is that Hezbollah is the strongest military force in Lebanon. The Lebanese armed forces, the army, is not the strongest force in Lebanon. Now, years ago, there was a negotiation, and the deal when Israel pulled out of its occupation of southern Lebanon was supposed to be, and that happened in 2000, that Hezbollah would lay down its arms. Hezbollah has always claimed correctly that they, now whether or not they should keep their arms is another question, but it is correct that the Lebanese armed forces are not capable of protecting Lebanon against the kind of attack that Israel can stage. And that is because the allies, the Western allies of Lebanon, are the same as the allies of Israel, and they do not arm the Lebanese armed forces to an extent where they could do any more than pretty minimal defensive procedures in their own country, because they don't want to anger Israel. So the truth is that actually Hezbollah is the only force that can defend southern Lebanon to the extent that it did in 2006. And 2006 changed a lot of people's attitudes towards Lebanon, towards Hezbollah as a force in Lebanon, because they did, in the end, win. That's how they see it, and a lot of Lebanese see it, and, you know, push Israel out and not allow Israel to achieve its aims in 2006. And there was a lot of surprise about how much they were able to do that. So as much as people say, many people in Lebanon who are not Hezbollah supporters say they're very frustrated about Hezbollah and the problems they create, the reality is they would want them to protect the country if a full all-out war does take place. And we saw a lot of cooperation between the army and Hezbollah during the middle years, 2015, 2016, when ISIS was spreading into Lebanon across the border from Syria. Hezbollah and the Lebanese armed forces fought together in a pincer movement to push ISIS out. So there is precedent for cooperation, and the armed forces, the Lebanese armed forces, already cooperate with Hezbollah in the south of Lebanon, as does the UN presence there. So we would likely see cooperation again between those different armed forces to try and stop Israel from conducting all-out war and fight against them if they do.
Leila Mulana Allen, thank you so much for joining us on the line from Lebanon. Still to come on today's programme. Oh, no prizes for guessing where Louis Vuitton is choosing to site its hotel in Paris. You're listening to The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
/7:24 here in London. A quick look now at today's newspapers. Joining me in the studio, Yossi Meckelberg, Associate Fellow with the Middle East and North Africa programme at Chatham House. Welcome back, Yossi. Good to see you.
Hello, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Let's talk about a story which has broken overnight and see how the papers are covering this. There is Israel has outlined its plans for the future of Gaza once the war between Israel and Hamas ends. Yoav Gallant, the Israeli defence minister, said that Hamas will no longer be in charge of the territory and there will be limited Palestinian rule. Could you outline a little bit more about what we're learning about this statement?
I think before I outline it, I think the Israeli government should outline it in any details that we can actually know, because, first of all, it's not an Israeli government as such plan. It's a Yoav Gallant plan that he introduced kind of late in a cabinet meeting last night. And already there is opposition to this from the far right.
It is interesting because the story, sorry to interrupt you, because the story broke overnight. And and normally when you have such an enormous plan for the future of a territory, which is currently the scene of intense conflict, you would imagine that there would have been a slightly more structured approach to an announcement. But no, this just broke.
You would, but this is almost typical. You know, throwing some ideas, it's more than any plan, it's some ideas. They said, A, Israel is still going to be in complete control and security on the borders. Then building more barriers on the border with Egypt, not only the border with Israel, because there is one part of Gaza that borders Egypt, which I'm a bit suspicious because actually this is exactly what didn't work on 7th October. So I have to learn, are there better barriers or the same kind we're going back? And talking about full military security responsibility in Gaza, that's exactly what happened before 7th of October, because there was blockade, there was full control of air and sea, and it still happened. What is missing now? And actually, one of the kind of qualifications there is was when the war is over, when Hamas is defeated. Now, we hear from some military strategists within the Israeli IDF that this might take a year or two. So nothing is going to happen quickly. Then we need emergency humanitarian aid. So if there is no timeline and there are no details, in my mind, there is no plan.
Are there any plans for the 2 million or so Palestinian citizens who have been displaced, who have been, you know, have seen their homes and their livelihoods destroyed? And you read of all these plans of, I think yesterday we mentioned in the paper review, of a discussion taking place with the Democratic Republic of Congo to move Palestinians across to various countries in Africa.
We keep hearing this. I don't think the 2.3 million people, and I hope so, no one going to have a serious discussion. When, for instance, and again, the immediate opposition to the so-called Glenn program would by the finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, from the very far-right party within government, said, no, the solution is to reduce the population of Gaza, listen to that, from 2.3 million to between 100 to 200,000. And when they talk about voluntary migration, what does it mean? Every single one of you is going to be asked. That's not what they mean by voluntary. Is it going to be a referendum? Is it going to be, you know, it's not voluntary. At the end of the day, what they are talking about is forced displacement, which is and sending them to exile. I don't think it's going to happen. There is no constituency for that.
Okay, let's move on to another story. What have you spotted in today's papers?
So here is the kind of the guessing game. When the next UK election, general election here?
Oh, this is exhausting, Yossi. We haven't even started. It's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, this is only the beginning of January. We're just dealing with removing all the decorations for Christmas and the same also. Now, the only reason there's no election in the UK is because the Conservatives, the Tory, won huge majority in the election exactly 4 years ago, December 2019. Now, there is expectation. Labour is leading 18% to the, 20% in the polls, so the expectation for them to win. It's the case that more than the Labour is loved is that the Conservatives are disliked and in disarray and disunited. Now, Labour is really keen for election, and in another headline in The Guardian, so about fighting fire with fire. for the conservative is the between they think they can still improve the economy by the time of election. So the later, the better. So beginning was talk about having election in May. Probably not going to happen because there won't be enough improvement. The so-called the tax cuts that suppose to improve the cost of living and the economic conditions probably won't kick in early enough for the conservative. So they try to postpone it. So there is a clash. The result of it is probably a quite nasty election campaign that probably started a year ago. And so by the time we have an election, it might be 2 years of this.
Brilliant. Can't wait. Right. What else have you spotted?
And the other thing which I think is interesting is about the issue, which also relate to what much of what's going to talk about in the British election is migration and immigration. And this is a huge debate. I just came back from 2 weeks in the United States. And the topic, one of the big topics is of course, of immigration, and only 2 days ago, and it was today, I spotted in the Washington Post, the leader of the House, the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, led the delegation because you need a photo opportunity. You go to the border, you talk how under President Biden the border is completely open, so just bring Donald Trump back and there won't be immigration and a lot of innuendo. And I think the interesting about this specific article in the Washington Post is how data is completely distorted by the Republicans. Like, for instance, talking about more migrants are arriving than baby born to American to American mothers in the United States. And I also the terminology, what does it mean American mothers? Is everyone that lives in America or very specific? So I think this kind of debate also, again, the election year, we know the date for American election this year in November, 7th of November. And I think the immigration issue is going to be very big. And the distortion of the data, how many are arriving. Again, for instance, while the Republicans love to blame the Biden administration, the Biden administration tell the Republicans, give me more funds, I'll make sure there are more judges. We can adjudicate it. Who can stay, can claim asylum. But they know, essentially, it's very good for Republicans to have more migrants that can do win think they can win elections.
Yossi Meckelberg, thank you as ever for joining me in the studio. You're listening to The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson. The time here in London is 7:32 a.m. A quick roundup now of the day's main headlines. Israel has outlined plans for the future of Gaza once the war between Israel and Hamas ends. The Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant said Hamas would no longer control the territory and there will be limited Palestinian rule. Islamic State has claimed responsibility for two explosions in Iran that killed nearly 100 people and wounded dozens of others. The group said two IS members had detonated explosive belts in a crowd that had gathered at a memorial for a top Iranian commander in the city of Kerman. Rescuers say there are still more than 240 people missing following the New Year's Day earthquake in Japan. The death toll after the tremor has now risen to 92. The former Paralympian Oscar Pistorius in the last few minutes has been released from jail in South Africa. The athlete left prison halfway through a 13-year sentence for the murder of his girlfriend, Reeva Steenkamp. And the Spice Girls are to become the first all-female group to feature on a British postage stamp. The Royal Mail is issuing a set of 15 stamps celebrating the UK band's 30th anniversary. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Now, Thailand's government wants to encourage more visitors and to boost its all-important tourism industry. And to do this, it's introducing measures such as cutting tax on alcohol, extending nightclub opening hours, and offering permanent visa-free entry for Chinese citizens. Well, to tell us more, I'm joined now by James Chambers, Monocle's Asia editor based in Bangkok. A very good afternoon to you, James.
Good morning, Emma.
You'd think that Thailand wouldn't need to do this, would you, given the fact that it is so dependent on tourism? So how far does it still have to go to get back to the levels that it saw before the pandemic?
Well, I guess everyone compares the current situation to 2019, which was a record year pre-COVID. And that's when 40 million people visited Thailand, which is a huge figure. So I guess that's the target that they need to get back to. But if you just look at, you know, where Thailand has come from during the depths of COVID, you know, in 2021, only 500,000 people came. Then the figure for 2023, 28 million, is a huge climb back. And it exceeds what the tourism authorities were targeting for last year. So Thailand is starting the year with some, you know, very in a very strong position with some very positive news. This is kind of the end of one of the high seasons when everyone kind of goes back after the new year, and I guess everyone's feeling very positive about it. But as the government looks ahead at this year, it is aiming to get back to that magical 40 million figure. And as you rightly said, they've just unveiled a suite of different measures, quite ambitious, quite impressive, to try and encourage more and more people to come, including, you know, making wine and beer cheaper to buy in Thailand rather than at the duty-free shops at the airport, and extending opening hours for clubs and bars. Although I'm sure most of our listeners would assume that Thailand and Bangkok especially was open very late already, but surprise, surprise, actually most bars shut around 1 or 2, but that has been extended now to 4 a.m. So, you know, those measures are hopefully going to spur even more numbers to visit this year.
One element that I mentioned a moment ago is visa-free entry for Chinese citizens. I mean, that's absolutely essential to Thailand's recovery, isn't it?
It is, because in that kind of magical year in 2019, of the 40 million people who came here, about 11 million were Chinese. That's one in four. The Chinese have been coming back, but only 3 million arrived last year. So there's still a long way to go. And they weren't the biggest country in terms of foreign arrivals. That was actually the neighboring country, Malaysia. So there's still a lot of room to get Chinese travelers to come back to Thailand, and there are many reasons why they're not necessarily coming back in such large figures just yet, both in here in Thailand and in China. But I guess the positive news for Thailand is that they're trying to diversify and not just rely on, you know, Chinese tourism, because as many countries in this region know, you'd be foolish just to rely on China, because they can use their tourism as a bit of a diplomatic weapon. So I think India is a big target for Thailand, and the Thai government has extended the visa-free agreements and arrangements for Indian visitors. So we're likely to see a lot more travelers come here from there. And if you look at the top five nationalities, you know, it's Malaysia, it's China, it's India, it's Russia, and it's South Korea. So, you know, Thailand is getting a lot of visitors from all around the region. It's not just, it hasn't got all its eggs in the Chinese basket.
Finally, you've been doing some interviews with various sort of high profile players in Thai hospitality in the last couple of weeks. And very much the feeling is that this is where people should be investing their money if they want to see good returns.
Yes, that's right. I mean, if you look at the figures, the Thai numbers are going up in terms of tourism. So you would be maybe smart to invest in Thai hospitality companies. But I guess what is interesting about from my conversations with these big groups is that a lot of the focus is always on foreign tourists coming into Thailand. But when you look at, you know, the direction of travel, these groups are expanding their footprint all around the world. You know, we feature an interview with one of the prominent executives at Dusitani, which is probably one of the best known Thai luxury hotel groups. Their flagship here is going to reopen in Bangkok, but they've got ambitious plans to open hotels all over the world and double the number that they already have and push into Europe for the first time. And they're not the only ones. A lot of the big hospitality groups are expanding in Japan. And this is partly to capture a lot of the you know, wealthy and middle-class Thais who are traveling a lot more, especially to places like Japan. So, you know, as we often talk about inward tourism to Taiwan, we're a lot, you know, people around the world are going to see a lot more Thai brands, hospitality brands, opening hotels in their countries.
James Chambers, thank you so much for joining us on the line from Bangkok. You're with Monocle Radio. It's 8:39 in Paris, which is where we head next, because diversifying from its core strengths of fashion, footwear and accessories is nothing new to the world of luxury. Guests can currently relax in Bulgari's hotels from the likes of Bali to Milan or enjoy a glass of Dolce & Gabbana rosé. Well, now Louis Vuitton is expanding into hotels too. Having opened a cafe on the roof of its store in the Japanese city of Osaka, a Louis Vuitton hotel is expected to open on the Champs-Élysées in Paris in 2026. And to tell us more, I'm joined now by Dana Thomas, the Paris-based author of Fashionopolis, The Price of Fast Fashion and the Future of Clothes. Good morning, Dana.
Good morning.
So just tell us a little bit about what Vuitton's plans are for this hotel.
Well, the hotel is going to be at number 103 Champs-Élysées, which is a block long. It's an enormous, enormous building that is right next door to its current boutique on the avenue at the corner of Avenue Georges V. And it's about a 120-year-old building. It used to be the HSBC Bank, and it was originally built as a hotel. It was a hotel until 1920, and it was famously where Mata Hari was arrested during the war, the spy, during the First World War, before she was later executed for being a spy. But they're going to turn it into this fabulous luxury hotel and boutique, of course. And there is talk that the current Louis Vuitton boutique, which is, or boutique is a kind word, it's a superstore, on the corner will become a Dior superstore. And mind you, this is all just up the street from the Dior headquarters and superstore and the Louis Vuitton boutique on the Avenue Montaigne. So they're really clustering and taking over a whole quartier of Paris with their stores.
What are we expecting the feel and the look of a Vuitton hotel to be?
Well, I imagine it's going to be very much like the store. It's going to be designed by Peter Marino and his team here in Paris. And it's going to be five-star luxury, you know, super top, not a bit like the five Cheval Blancs that are in the world already, one of them being across the street from the Louis Vuitton headquarters at the Pont Neuf. Very sleek, very modern, very elegant, and very expensive.
How important is it to luxury brands like the likes of Vuitton and Bulgari to diversify into areas of hospitality? Because there's always that fear, isn't there, that, you know, some do, some don't, and there is a fear that you might dilute your brand if you start to have too many facets to your identity.
Well, it seems that hotels have worked well. Bulgari, mind you, is also owned by LVMH, so they have those 13 hotels, or actually I think there's 14 now. There's one in Paris that just opened recently around the corner from where the Louis Vuitton is going to be. And then there's Giorgio Armani's hotels. There's the Dolce & Gabbana hotels, and Dolce & Gabbana is actually moving also into residences for apartments where you can just go and buy an apartment that's done in the whole Dolce & Gabbana look and world. That's the first one's going to be in Miami, and then there's also the Versace hotels. It does add to the, like, if you buy into this brand, you can live the brand 100%, as they've done with Dolce & Gabbana. Like, if you're into maximalism and you love their clothes, you can go vacation and wear their clothes in their hotels with their decor, and you fit right in. So it's for a very certain kind of clientele, and that's a clientele that is devoted to the brand. The luxury brands right now are really focusing on the super uber rich and really just trying to get them to spend all the money they have on their stuff. So this is another way to get them to part with their money.
How is this going down in Paris? Because I mean, when you see what Vuitton has done in the last, 12 months, we're just looking at the Pharrell Williams spring summer menswear debut that they sort of totally took over the Pont Neuf and the middle of Paris. And then you talked there about the sort of the uber luxury quartier with Dior and also with Vuitton. Is there a sense that Paris is becoming very luxury, super publicly super branded?
Yes, and LVMH branded. And I was at a Christmas party just 3 weeks ago where this was the talk of the party, and everybody was saying enough, we're fed up with Bernard Arnault turning Paris into his personal town. It's interesting because the Conrad shop, which had been here since 1992, just around the corner here and next across the street from the Bon Marché department store, also an LVMH brand, just closed. And it is said that it's going to also become a Louis Vuitton hotel. That's the talk in the neighborhood. So it's interesting that You know, he's taking over, but the Parisians are getting a little bit fed up and saying, you know, enough already. We have enough of your stuff around us.
Dana Thomas, thank you so much for joining us on the line from Paris. You're listening to The Globalist on Monocle Radio.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
I'm joined now by the film critic and regular Monocle Radio contributor, Karen Krasanovich, for the latest movie news for 2024. But Karen Krasanovich, you brought in a book.
I brought in a book.
And you're reading the book.
I've
never had a guest come in and bring a book just in case she gets bored.
I brought the complete screenplay of Oppenheimer.
It's a biggie.
Yeah, I've seen the movie twice and now I'm reading the book. Pretty soon I'm going to, I don't know, watch the play. Who knows what I'll do.
All right. So you brought in a book which is an adaptation. Well, no, hang on a minute. That was an original screenplay.
It's actually an adapted screenplay. And I brought this along as a physical reminder for everybody on the radio that there is a difference between screenplays. There's original screenplays or scripts and adapted screenplays and scripts. You may think, why is this important?
Why is this important, Karen?
Because without a script, you don't have a movie. Even though you can improvise, still, you need some guidelines. As David Leeds said to his costume designer, read the instructions. And this is what we're talking about this morning, about the fact that the WGA, the Writers Guild, who are giving their awards on April the 14th of this year, which is after the Oscars, March the 10th, is playing fast and loose with the categories. You may think, this is really boring. Why are you talking about this?
Well, no, I trust you, Karen. Where are you leading us?
Yeah, where are we? Well, we've got Greta Gerwig and Noah Baumbach, the married couple whose original script for Barbie has been nominated by the WGA as an original script, meaning it's not based on anything. And the Empass, the Oscar people, are putting it in the adapted script.
Adapted from what? The original idea of a doll?
Exactly. Yes. Boy, okay. You're fast this morning.
Thank you.
It took me a while to figure that one out. But that's exactly right. And you may think, well, what's the big deal there? And it's puzzling because we don't know why Empress has done that. But the problem is that it puts this very strong script into another very strong category, along with the book I'm holding right here, Oppenheimer, which is adapted from a Pulitzer Prize winning printing book that took 20 years to do. I mean, this is a long haul, this one. But also, Empass has moved Ava DuVernay's screenplay for Origin, which is, you know, an incredible film. Not a lot of people have seen it yet. It's loosely based on Cast, The Origins of a Discontent, Isabel Wilkerson's book. So this means that we have got such a mix in this category of scripts that maybe should have been in a different category where there's less competition.
Does this mean that there will be problems come Oscar night when whoever it is announced, and that will immediately spark a debate that that's a real, you know, original screenplay, that's not, this isn't, and as a result, it causes more problems in the long term?
Well, it really does, and it also calls up, number one, it causes problems in the long run because some scripts like Ava DuVernay's aren't getting the attention that they should get because they're right next to Barbie and Oppenheimer, the two big winners of 2023. But also, it calls up questions of IP. What are we calling an original idea? What are we calling not original? I mean, you can't just fabricate a script out of nothing. It has to be based on something. So I'm finding this a noteworthy piece of information because it really is the bedrock of where the industry sits.
Okay. What else are we looking forward to in 2024 apart from problematic award ceremonies? I've never heard of a straightforward award ceremony.
There's got to be one somewhere. It's just very boring and we're not watching it. I just wanted to bring up some films for 2024, what you can look forward to. Mean Girls by Tina Fey. It's not based on the film you're thinking of. It's the stage musical. It's another musical. Gladiator 2, Ridley Scott, with Denzel and Paul Mescal and Jimin Hunzu, who's one of my favorites, and also Derek Jacobi, or is it Jacobi?
I always assumed it was Jacobi, but I could be wrong.
I think I say Jacobi, but I'm American, and I think it's probably wrong. We also have the Spider-Man movie franchise without Spider-Man. That's Madam Web with Dakota Johnson.
Okay, so tell us a little bit more about the non-spider Spider-Man.
Okay, all right.
This spin-off, the Spider-Man has had high spin-offs like Venom. Well, okay, you could call it high. And Lowe's, Morbius. But Madam Web stars as a clairvoyant Spidey side character who might be worth sticking around for.
Very funny. At what point do we actually hear the sound of a barrel being scraped with this?
I think we can hear it pretty clearly already. We've already got Gladiator 2. We've got Madam Web. We've got Deadpool 3. We've got Furioso, another spinoff, which, of course, with great costume work from Jenny Bevan, worth seeing. We've got Beetlejuice 2, but hold it. We've also got a musical, Joker, Folie à Deux.
So this is all sequels, because we've got June 2 sequels. That everyone's getting very
That's
excited
right.
about.
What I wonder what a Joker, Folie à Deux, is going to be called in French. Anyway, and we've also got Dune 2. So the big things that we're looking forward to are really sending a signal that this is IP, intellectual property, content that we already know. It's familiar. And this just goes to show how risk-averse Hollywood is being at the minute.
These are bankers, all of them, aren't they?
Pretty much.
And as a result, does this mean that we're all going to be falling in love with going to the cinema again in 2024? Because apparently we've been, well, since the pandemic, we've all been falling back in love with cinema. How much longer can we keep falling in love with cinema? When are we just going to be sort of steady with cinema?
According to Gower Street Analytics, is my favorite go-to company for this kind of information. The global box office was up 30%, so at $33.9 billion. And that's, much, much better than 2022. Now, this is because of Barbie, Super Mario, which I still haven't seen, Oppenheimer, and a few others. But this is going to, this does mean that we have started coming back to the cinema. Maybe people that haven't gone to the cinema are going now, but there's going to be a big hiccup coming because of the strike, 6 months of no.
What's going to happen? I mean, and also in terms of the writers' strikes from last year, how much is that going to be noticed in what we see this year?
Well, there's been discussions. I had a meeting yesterday. There's been discussions in the industry. Some people think it's going to be a great flood. Others think it's going to be a huge hiccup. And I think moviegoers are going to see a big gap in new stuff. So expect to see re-releases of films you've already seen.
Really? What are we going to have re-released?
Well, I'm just anticipating that. I just think that you're going to have to do something to fill the theaters, fill the movie theaters. Not even talking about streaming. I'm talking about the big screen. So many projects have either been put on hiatus or canceled. It's going to be very interesting. See, nobody quite knows yet.
Karen Krasanovich, thank you as ever for joining us on Monocle Radio.
Become a Monocle magazine subscriber today and enjoy 10% off any annual subscription. It's time to get a truly global view that's upbeat and optimistic. Monocle has plenty more in store for 2023 that will keep you informed, entertained, and, of course, ahead of the game. With a global roster of correspondents and bureau, we deliver stories that you won't find elsewhere. Expect insights on everything from diplomacy and design to art and architecture and more. Sign up today and you'll receive 10 issues and seasonal specials full of inspiration. Visit monocle.com/subscribe and enter the code RADIO10 to redeem this offer.
Finally, 7:53 here in London. Much of the world is packing up the Christmas decorations today. It's 12th night. However, in Finland, there's a final blaze of light into the dark as Lux Helsinki goes into its final weekend. The festival tries to brighten up life in the Finnish capital during the darkest time of the year with big public light art installations. And to tell us more, I'm joined now from Finland by Petri Burtsov, Monocle's Helsinki correspondent. Welcome, Petri. Welcome back.
Good morning, Emma, and greetings from a very, very chilly Helsinki. It's about minus 16 degrees Celsius outside, and I was touring some of the artworks of Lux Helsinki last night, and while they were amazing, as they are every year, I have to say it was quite a struggle to sort of walk around the city for several hours in those really, really freezing temperatures.
I did want to ask you about that, because it's been the world has noticed that it's cold where you are, and when you are trying to organise an enormous public light art installation in your capital. I mean, how much do you have to factor in that people might just be too cold to go outside?
Yes, you do have to factor it in. But let's remember that it always takes place in the beginning of January, the first week of January. So it's always cold. But I mean, there's a difference between sort of a little bit below zero and then, you know, close to minus 20. So yeah, you have to factor it in. But I mean, they have some galleries involved this year and they have some indoor art, but this has always been, I mean, the event has been running since 2009 and it's really, really popular. I think before the pandemic, they attracted something like 600,000 visitors. You know, that's the population of Helsinki. Think about the same, what that would mean for London. So, you know, people want to brave the cold because it means just so much for the city to have this light festival in the darkest time of the year.
Tell us a little bit about what you will see if you do venture outside. What does it look like?
Right. So the first thing I would say is that when you think about light art and, you know, these are not small artworks. These are usually the size of a buildings. In fact, some of the artworks are the size of several buildings, you know, light projections and installations. And they're just very large scale because they're usually in public spaces in downtown Helsinki where lots of people gather and there's lots of space. So, for example, I mean, some of the highlights that I saw yesterday evening at the in front of the Audi Library, Finland's Helsinki's new sort of national library, there was this wonderful talking heads installation. These two gigantic heads made up of LED lights that sort of interacted with each other. I think each one of them had something like 4,000 different LEDs. It was just really, really nice, and the kids liked it as well. And then on the Senate Square, sort of, this is the iconic Helsinki skyline with the Helsinki Cathedral. They had basically lit up all the major buildings, the university, the government building, and the Helsinki Cathedral in this video installation, and had installed large speakers as well, so it was a kind of a full show there. And then some of the other works are a little bit more intimate at the Helsinki's main cemetery. They have this video and sound installation that plays the Finlandia hymn, sort of Finland's unofficial national anthem that gets all the Finns emotional. So it's kind of a mix between this like bold and grandiose and then more intimate artworks.
Indeed, and they've even put enormous installations up at the zoo, which I can imagine might be a little bit strange for the animals.
Yeah, they have. They have, and I think some of these installations actually involve lizards. So yeah, that's also one thing. I mean, this is one thing that I really like about it. I mean, it's not only this like grandiose thing in the downtown, but it's also, you know, spread out into the suburbs, into the zoo, as you said, and into smaller galleries. And it's basically just all over the city. It's basically light art taking over the entire city for a week.
Finally, Petri, the Finns are expert at darkness. And as Twelfth Night is nigh here in the Northern Hemisphere, and we are going into the darkest part of the year for many, what advice could a Finn give to the rest of the world for survival?
Right. Well, what we do is we kind of like hibernate. You know, we just, apart from it looks Helsinki when people go outside, but usually we just stay indoors, light up some nice candles, fire in the fireplace, have some nice hot chocolate. Just, I think the Danes have a lovely word for it, hygge. You know, we do something very similar. It's basically just staying indoors and getting comfy, putting a woolen socks on and a woolen blanket and just enjoying it.
Petri Burtsov, thank you as ever for joining us on The Globalist. And that's all the time we have for today's programme. The warmest of thanks to all my guests and to the producers, Sophie Monaghan-Coombs, Laura Kramer and Chris Chermak. Our researcher was Nirma Ekwe and our studio manager was Steph Chungu. After the headlines, there's more music on the way. The briefing's back at midday here in London. I hope you can join me for that if you can. And The Globalist returns at the same time on Monday. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.